And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
Welcome to Third Hour, this week's fully independent radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. We'll be starting off this week with a short interview I got from a righteous dude named Jacob who got kicked out of China during the Olympics. He was a very, very bad boy. That'll be followed by This Week in Palestine, giving you a non-Zionist, non-Western point of view from the occupied lands themselves. Then we'll bring you Peak Oil Check-In, which I could not fit in the last hour. Sorry about that. And we'll finish big with the hilarity of Scooter and his Interside radio program. So sit back and enjoy this ride. And as always, thanks for listening.
Years from now, when you talk about this, and you will, be kind.
The following is an interview with Jacob, who received international attention when he and a group of supporters unfurled a Free Tibet banner during the Olympic Games and was immediately deported from China for it. Here's that 8-minute interview. This is Mike Cannon. I'm with Jacob, who got kicked out of China. And I'm just wondering, Jacob, if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about that experience and why that had happened.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, for having me. I went to China this summer with Students for Free Tibet. We went in the end of August during the Olympics in Beijing. And we went there to hold up a banner that said Free Tibet in English and Chinese to show the world and to show Chinese government to show them that people aren't ignoring what's going on in Tibet. In Tibet, in the last 6 months, there's been tons of people kicked out and rounded up so that there couldn't be any protests during the Olympics. The Olympics in China was their moment to show the world that that it's friendly to Western governments for investment and that they have no problems. Tibet has been a huge problem in their image since it is a place where people are fighting for their liberation peacefully, but also also struggling sometimes hard. So China had to cover that up, and they couldn't let that issue dominate the their 3 weeks of glory and fame. So what groups like Students for Free Tibet did, or folks in Tibet themselves, or in India, or in Canada, or in San Francisco, just held banners and did protests all over the world. I was one out of seven groups in Beijing that did an action in August. Americans, Germans, British folks, and Tibetan exiles went to Beijing and held banners, opened up flags, ran through the streets, did a die-in, did a banner drop from poles. What our group did was on the night of August 19th, at about midnight, five of us who were staying in Beijing for about a week, we went to this place called the Olympic Park, which from the Olympic Park you could see the Bird's Nest, which was the national stadium, and the Cube, which was the National Aquatic Stadium, and also Olympic Tower. We got there, and we had this 20-foot banner that said in LED lights, Free Tibet, in English and then also in Mandarin. We opened that banner, you know, for about 30 seconds, and it was pretty quiet park. We opened the banner, and within 30 seconds, there was about 10 undercover policemen who ripped it away from us and surrounded us. Fortunately, in those 30 seconds, there was a photo taken and video taken. And those people didn't get arrested. They got out. And within 2 hours, there was a photo and video up on the web. But we didn't know that happened. We didn't know there was a photo or a video taken. We sat there. We sat there talking to international press on the phone about why we did it. About, you know, no matter what happens to us, folks in Tibet are struggling way harder than we are. And, we can take this. They surrounded us. They invited more and more cops to come over to us and just videotape us. They took our passports. They tried to listen to what we were saying in English. After about an hour and a half or 2 hours of just sitting there, they finally put us into a car, and they had like two or three cars following us. They took us to some empty building that wasn't a police station. It was just some kind of university building that wasn't used at night. And they took us there, and they interrogated us each individually about why we were there, who's our leader, are we getting paid for this? Who do we work for? Do we know what Tibet is? Don't we know that China has always owned Tibet? Don't we know that, like, we're stupid? And they basically, like, you know, tried to tell us how wrong we were. And they tried to get us to say who we were working for and whether or not we were working for the U.S. government. Because they thought the government might have sent us to disrupt China's image because China's rising to power. But no, we said, no, we're not. We're just working here. And we're just fighting for Tibet to be free.
That sounds pretty amazing. It sounds paranoid. It's kind of interesting because all you hear is that America and China has this great relationship. Obviously, they have a pretty darn good economic one going on. So for some of my Central Wisconsin listeners, I'm just wondering if you can maybe just give a little bit of brief understanding to them exactly what is the Tibetan struggle.
So Tibet is a autonomous region in southwestern China, and it was a country for about 50 years in the first half of the 20th century. When a lot of countries were being born. And it had its own religious and ethnic population of Tibetans, and the religion is Tibetan Buddhism. It's very strong ancient history. And it wasn't a democracy. It was actually a monarchy. But it was an independent country, and it was changing. In 1950, when Mao became president of the People's Republic of China, they invaded Tibet because they saw Tibet as what they said, a backwards country, and they had to modernize it. So they invaded it with military and destroyed tons of the monasteries because they thought monasteries were feudal, and anything feudal should be just destroyed, and they should be brought into the People's Republic. Now, as that happened, tons of Tibetans fled. The Dalai Lama went to exile in India. He set up a government in Dharamsala, India, from which to direct the people, or to direct an exile movement. From that time, there's been a struggle to free Tibet, and to do it in different ways. There was a guerrilla struggle for about 10 years, but that ended badly because China had a huge army. And so since then, it's been a nonviolent struggle, and a lot of people have been supporting it because they see it as a continuation of a Gandhian struggle, because the Dalai Lama is really influenced by Gandhi's actions, and they try to do a lot of peaceful protests, large-scale demonstrations, self-immolation, to get the press out there about them. And for 50 years, the Dalai Lama hasn't been back, and the people are still being under the domination of Chinese rule. And they're starting to do population transfers of bringing Chinese nationals into Tibet to kind of to change the ethnic makeup of it, so that in 50 more years, there won't be enough people to fight for it.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. I heard about that. They just totally bring in a whole bunch of outside people that just totally waters down whatever populations they might have. This way, they'd have more political, but also it starts affecting them culturally too, as their indigenous people start getting less and less prominent in the culture. Jacob, do you have anything else you want to add about the issue you're struggling? By the way, how long did you stay before they kind of kicked you out of the country?
Well, we were there for a week, and then after we got arrested, we spent 12 hours in detention, and then they sent us on a plane directly home. They tried to get us to pay for it, but they couldn't find our money, so they had to pay for it. And yeah, they were pretty mad at us, but it was an interesting place. And I was shocked about how different it was than I expected it to be. It's very urban, modernized. I mean, beyond like urban space, like way more than that in New York City. The architecture there was out of control. It was like being in another land. I mean, I don't understand. But what I want people to take away from this is that there's lots of similarities to other national liberation struggles around the world. And I think with China's role rising in the world, and maybe it's a good thing that the U.S. is falling, but it occurs in a vacuum. China is like becoming the dominant leader, and it could be the country that it guarantees the financial structure of the world. And if it does, there will be this powerful movement to question that structure. It is the internal opposition to that power. And if that's the case, then that movement should be supported, not just because it's a support for people's human rights and people's dignity, but it's a support that challenges the dominant order in China itself, which is hard to do from abroad. So I think it's really important to think about that internal opposition, which if there's none, then it'll be unquestioned.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it, Jacob.
Thank you. And now the winner of the best Central Wisconsin community radio station as voted by us computer voices, WNRB.
This week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for October 25th through 31st, 2008. The third Free Gaza boat arrives in Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinians mark the 91st anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Palestinian parties are set to meet in Cairo for unity talks, while Israelis are preparing for early elections. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's start our weekly report, as usual, with the nonviolent actions in Palestine, where Palestinians marked the 91st anniversary of the Balfour Declaration of 1917 in their anti-wall nonviolent protests this week. Israeli troops wounded a 7-year-old Palestinian boy as they attacked nonviolent protesters who were demonstrating against the apartheid wall Israel is building in Al-Masara village south of Bethlehem on Friday at noon. Mohammed Brejiya, spokesperson of the Popular Committee Against the Wall in Bethlehem suburb, said this demonstration is also to mark the 91st anniversary of the Balfour Declaration of 1917, during which Lord Balfour, the Foreign Secretary of the UK, declared his government's support for establishing home for the Jewish people in Palestine. The protesters carried Palestinian flags and signs condemning the Balfour Declaration. Troops obstructed the marchers and shot tear gas and concussion grenades at them. Eyewitnesses reported that Abada Zawahra was wounded in his arm and face as he was pushed by the soldiers, causing him bruises. Zawahra was transferred to a nearby clinic for medical treatment. In the nearby Al-Khadr village, the residents organized a prayer at the main road in protest of the confiscation of their land by Israel for the construction of the apartheid wall. Samer Jaber, one of the organizers of the protest, spoke to IMEMC.
Today at Al-Khadr, tens of Palestinian farmers congregated to hold the prayer on their certain land, where the path of the wall is going to cut them from their own lands. They held this prayer to send a message to the entire world that they are struggling and striving to protect their own lands, that they depend totally on this land to earn their own daily resources.
Today, the villagers of Bel'in organized a march after the Friday prayer against the construction of the apartheid wall on their land. The villagers were joined by a number of international and Israeli human rights activists. The protest also marked the 52nd anniversary of the massacre of Kfar Qasim and the 91st anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Protesters carried Palestinian flags and signs holding the United States and Britain responsible for the conditions in Palestine, for their support for Israel that is ongoing with building the wall and more settlements on Palestinian land. The Vice President of the European Union, Luisa Morgantini, joined the protest with one other parliamentarian, Chris Davis. Israeli troops came through the gate and pushed Luisa Morgantini and Chris Davis, who fell down to the ground. As the protest reached the fence, troops closed the gate, stopping the protesters from going through, and fired tear gas and concussion grenades, causing dozens to choke. Troops also fired several rounds of rubber-coated steel bullets, injuring 7 people. The wounded were identified as Ponal Jose, Maysoon Azam, a reporter for Al Arabiya TV, in addition to Iyad Burnat, Adib Abu Rahma, Kamil Al-Khatib, and Abdullah Abu Rahma from Bel'in. A music band from the USA called Olive Trees Circus played guitar, accordion, and sung for peace during the action. 4 Palestinians were wounded in Na'aleen today as the Popular Committee Against the Apartheid Wall in the village organized the weekly protest on Friday midday. Mayor of Na'aleen, Ayman Nafi', told IMEMC that the protesters were completely nonviolent. However, the Israeli troops attacked them with rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas canisters. He identified the injured as Khamis Amira, 28, Imad Tantour, 18, and both were wounded in the arms, while Saad Amira, 20, was wounded with rubber-coated steel bullet in the face. Meanwhile, Ala Khawaja was wounded in the back. The 4 were treated in the medical center in the village, and their wounds were described as moderate. In the Gaza Strip, the Free Gaza Movement announced on Wednesday the arrival of its third Gaza boat, SS Dignity, to the Gaza shores in bid of breaking the Israeli blockade of the coastal territory imposed for the past 17 months. The new boat is loaded with 27 international Arab and Palestinian peace activists who sailed from Cyprus despite bad weather conditions in the regions. Despite bad weather conditions in the region and despite threats by Israeli Navy gunships to stop their boat. The Free Gaza Movement issued a press release on Tuesday saying that they have received information through media that Israeli Navy is threatening to forcibly stop the boat from entering Gaza without providing any reason for that. On August 23rd, SS Liberty and Free Gaza boats arrived in Gaza shores in solidarity with the besieged Gaza's 1.5 million residents. As the Palestinian political parties are set to meet on November 9th in a Cairo-hosted National Unity Conference, Israel parliamentary blocs are preparing for early elections called for by the head of the ruling Kadima party, Tzipi Livni. More with IMEMC's Rami Alwigari in Gaza Strip.
Representatives of Palestinian factions involving the ruling Hamas party in Gaza and the Fatah party of the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will participate in a comprehensive national unity dialogue in Cairo with the hope of ending their divisions and forming a national unity government. The Hamas party in Gaza welcomed a Cairo-prepared document that sets the broad lines for successful talks between Hamas and Fatah, which have been at loggerheads since Hamas took power in 2006 parliamentary elections. Earlier this week, in an interview with IMMC's Rami Al-Mighari and was published on the website of Electronic Intifada.net website, Dr. Ahmed Youssef, advisor of the Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniya, commented.
The Cairo document is a good to start with. There are some reservations, yes, but this is something that we will be able to solve when we sit together and address these issues. We have some concern. Some of the things need to be clarified with the Egyptians and with the rest of the Palestinian political parties, and that's what we're going to address in Cairo when we meet in November 9th, inshallah.
The Fatah party also welcomed the document, as Fatah spokesperson Ahmed Abdurrahman said his party is heading for Cairo to end the division and return to the situation back prior to June 2007, when Hamas took over Gaza. Other Palestinian factions in Gaza voiced the same stance, looking forward to a successful Cairo dialogue. Meanwhile, on Thursday, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza released 17 Fatah members jailed in Gaza prisons for the past several months. Hamas calls this a goodwill gesture for the upcoming dialogue. Also, Hamas called on the Fatah-allied Palestinian government in the West Bank to take a similar step by releasing more than 100 Hamas supporters. In an interview with the IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari, Fawzi Barhoum, Hamas spokesman in Gaza, commented.
They are listening to Hamas supporters and leaders and the prominent members in West Bank. According to the implementation of the, unfortunately, the security part of the roadmap, and according to the security collaboration with the occupation, they are listening to Hamas supporters and leaders and the prominent members in West Bank.
This week, Israeli media sources said that the head of the ruling Kadima party, Tzipi Livni, called for elections after she has exhausted all possible efforts to form a coalition government involving all Israeli political parties. Also this week, in the Israeli parliament, the leader of the Israeli opposition, Benjamin Netanyahu, pledged to his party that his political platform will not include any concessions for the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, mainly on subject of Jerusalem and the problem of Palestinian refugees. Earlier, Livni voiced willingness to continue negotiations with the Palestinians until reaching a peaceful settlement by the end of this year, as envisioned by the outgoing U.S. administration during last year's Annapolis Peace Conference, mainly a two-state solution. Related development. Israel's President Shimon Peres reiterated with the Egyptian counterpart during a meeting in the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh his willingness for comprehensive peace talk with the Arab world.
This week, Israeli military killed one Palestinian old man and wounded at least two others as the Israeli military invasions Palestinian cities, towns, villages, and refugee camps continued. More with IMEMC's Jessica Husley in the West Bank.
An elderly man, age 67, from the city of Jenin, was shot dead earlier this week by Israeli soldiers. The man was checking on his livestock nearby when the soldiers opened fire, killing him instantly. Meanwhile, the Israeli troops shot and wounded two Palestinian residents from the Fara refugee camp after invading the camp early this week. As part of the Israeli attacks on the West Bank, Israeli troops carried out more than 20 invasions into Palestinian areas, including Bethlehem, Hebron, Nablus, Tukaram, and Qalqilia, rounding up dozens of Palestinian residents. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, the daily detention campaigns conducted by the Israeli troops in the West Bank has led to the imprisonment of 2,074 Palestinian residents since the beginning of 2008. For other related news, this week, armed Israeli soldiers in the West Bank continued their daily attacks on Palestinian farmers while picking olives amidst the olive season, a major source of income for the Palestinian population. The American General Consul in Jerusalem, Jacob Wallace, expressed his concern over the continued settler attacks on Palestinians, saying that his administration has asked Israel for clarifications on this matter. Another development this week, Hamas sources have said that the West Bank-based Palestinian security services conducted a series of arrest campaigns against Hamas members and supporters. The sources added that more than 40 Hamas affiliates have been rounded up so far, particularly after Israel allowed the deployment of 500 Palestinian security personnel in the southern West Bank city of Hebron. For IMEMC, this is Jessica Holsey.
As an uneasy ceasefire is established since June between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza, the situation in the coastal territory remains tense. The details from Gaza with IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari.
On Thursday, the local committee for breaking the Israeli blockade on Gaza condemned the continued Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip after the Israeli military closed all Gaza's commercial crossings. The Israeli army closures of the crossings were based on reports that a homemade shell landed in nearby Israeli areas during the weekend. Also, the Israeli troops claimed that two shells were fired at an Israel tank near the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, the Israeli army was reported for shooting and wounding a Palestinian girl near the city of Khan Yunis earlier this week. In the meantime, amidst a crippling Israeli blockade in the region, as well as an internationally enforced embargo, a third free Gaza boat, Hope, arrived on the shores of Gaza this week. The boat had 27 internationals on board, including both Arab and Palestinian peace activists who came in a bid of solidarity with the besieged Gaza population after two boats broke the siege on August 23. For other related news, a number of Palestinian resistance factions which agreed to the Egyptian brokered ceasefire deal warned of the collapse of the current truce with Israel if Israel continues to close the crossings or attack Palestinian areas daily. The June ceasefire agreement stipulated the reopening of Gaza's crossings completely, leading to a gradual end of the siege in return for halting homemade shell fire from Gaza into Israel. Another concern, Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak told the Yedioth Ahronot Israeli newspaper that the captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit held by Hamas in Gaza since June 2006 is in a good health. Egypt has been brokering Israeli-Palestinian negotiations over a possible prisoner swap in which hundreds of Palestinian prisoners can be released by Israel in return for Shalit. At the internal level, the Hamas-led Interior Ministry in Gaza set a free 17 Fatah Party members who have been kept inside Gaza prisons for the past month. Hamas says the move is intended to prepare the atmosphere for the upcoming Cairo-based Palestinian national talks slated for November 9. For IMEMC.org, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
And that was just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check our website www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and George Shmawi. Goodbye.
Peak Oil Check-In. Exploring the end of the age of oil.
A world with energy doubled in price. That's a scenario for the year 2020 that 150 people in Addison County, Vermont considered for a day last weekend. Paul Ralston, executive director of the Vermont Coffee Company, laid out the scenario in detail at the beginning of one of the working groups.
In 2020, we are 12 years older. Gas costs about $8 a gallon, diesel $10 a gallon. electricity 25 cents a kilowatt hour, and dry firewood costs $600 a cord. Atmospheric carbon is at 410 parts per million compared to 387 today, and the safe limit of 350 parts per million. Federal and state funding for schools, roads, health care, Social Security, unemployment, and income support is 50% lower than it is today. Local goods and services represent 50% of the county's economy compared to 10% today.
The participants' task was to figure out what they want their world to look like under that scenario, and then figure out how to move in that direction. The exercise was the heart of the county's 7th Conservation Congress. The focus was on how to respond to peak oil, climate change, and the financial unraveling. Inspired by the Transition Towns movement that began in England, the organizers invited the community to plan together for radical, desirable transformations. David Brin, executive director of a key sponsoring organization, Vermont Family Forests, put it this way.
Celebrate. We can make the transition. We are very fortunate to live in an amazingly beautiful and verdant place. We are also fortunate to live in a place rich in human resources and creativity. Today, as we explore the transition that global climate change, peaking oil supplies, and a rapidly changing economy now require, we must not forget to celebrate the human ingenuity, capacity, and creativity of our Addison County community. Look around, listen to your neighbors, celebrate what we are doing, tell your story. There's already so much happening for which to be grateful.
Similarly, John Elder put the participants in the mood to imagine a positive but very different future.
We need to visualize what and whom we love in the present of our place. I remember hearing David Suzuki speak once about some of these necessary changes. And at the end of the lecture, someone put up their hand and said, but do you really think that people in a country like this are willing to lower our standard of living? And his answer was, I'm talking about raising our standard of living. If we could live closer to where we work in larger multi-generational groups, if we could grow and cook more of our own food, if we could transport ourselves much more with muscle power, if we could provide more of our own entertainment, we would be moving in the direction not only of stewardship, but of pleasure, shared pleasure, not just sitting in heavy traffic in a really expensive car.
This was no mere lip service to celebration and beauty. The main work of the day was done in 12 separate rooms, each addressing a pair of related issues. Money and banking was one, food and farming was another, a third was heat and power. In each room, a visual artist listened to the discussions and summed up the discussions in a painting. The paintings were later taped together to form a long roll, and the roll was wound through a vaudeville-era device called a cranky. It was like showing a slideshow, but just with drawings. Pete Sutherland, who wrote and performed the theme music for the Peak Oil Check-In, accompanied the cranky show with his song about peak oil called Nothing But Wisdom.
When the wells run dry and the trucks don't roll, when the pilot light is out and they've had to quit the coal, when the sky is for the birds and the roads are for your feet, we will all want less and appreciate it more.
At the end of the day, each of the 12 working groups had produced not only a painting, but also a vision statement for their theme, 10 goals for the year 2020, and 3 ideas on how to move forward towards those goals. Next week, I'll talk about some of the ways these groups envisioned a hopeful and energy-poor 2020. I'm Carl Ettenier, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In. Thanks for the music, Pete.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Explore the many decades of popular music Thursday nights on Round Trip with Neil at the Wheel. Two solid commercial-free hours of rock, blues, jazz, folk, and everything in between. Thank you. That's Round Trip with Neil at the Wheel, Thursdays from 7 to 9 p.m., only on 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau.
Everyone's a winner, bargains galore. That's right, you two can be the proud owner. The quality goes in before that name goes on. One-tenth of a dollar, one-tenth of a dollar. We got service after sale. How about perfume? We got perfume. How about an engagement ring? Some for the little lady, some for the little lady, some for the little lady. $3-4. We got a year-end clearance, we got our white sale, and a smoke-damaged furniture, you can drive it away today. Act now, and receive our gift to you. They come in all colors, one size fits all. No muss, no fuss, no spills, you tired of kitchen drudgery, everything must go. Going out of business, going out of business, going out of business sale. 50% off original retail price, skip the middleman. Don't settle for less. How do we do it? How do we do it? Volume, volume, turn up the volume. Turn to the Chase Lounge for several weeks. And it plays a mean rhythm master. It makes excuses for unwanted lipstick on your collar. And it's only a dollar. Step right up. It's only a dollar. Step right up. It forges your signature. Not completely satisfied. Mail back unused portion of product for complete refund of price of purchase. Step right up. Please allow 30 days for delivery. Don't be fooled by cheap imitations. You can live in it, laughing it, loving it, swimming it, sleeping it, living it, swimming it, laughing it, loving it. Remove embarrassing stains from contour sheets. That's right. And it entertains visiting relatives. It turns a sandwich into a banquet. Tired of being the life of the party. Change your shorts, change your life. Change your life. Change into a 9-year-old Hindu boy. Get rid of your wife. It walks your dog. Doubles on sacks. Doubles on sacks. You can jump back, Jack. See you later, alligator. See you later, alligator. And it steals your car. It gets rid of your gambling debts. It quits smoking. It's a friend. It's a companion. It's the only product you will ever need. Follow these easy assembly instructions. It never needs ironing. Well, it takes weights off hips, bust, thighs, chin, mid-rib. Never needs binding. Never needs binding. Never needs binding. Gets rid of blackheads, heartbreakers, psoriasis. Christ, you don't know the meaning of heartbreak, buddy. Come on, come on. Come on, come on. Gives you an erection, it wins the election. Why put up with painful corns any longer? It's a redeemable coupon, no obligation, no salesman will visit your home. We got a jackpot, jackpot, jackpot. Prizes, prizes, prizes.
Fellow Americans, my name is Scooter, and I welcome you to the Inner Side Radio program produced at KPFT Pacifica Radio. Right off the Third Coast, Houston, Texas, where the women are strong, the men are drunk, and the children are air-conditioned from birth.
Thank you. I've been part of this group. It's been very exciting. I'm the only non-academic in this group, and I've gotten to really appreciate what the academicians do. It's very interesting work. I really have a lot of respect for them, and I really am glad they put up with the non-academic being with them in their group. Second thing I'd like to clarify using the word evolution, and that just brings up all sorts of definitions. We'll give you a handout, but not today. But let me explain some of the use of the words that I'll be using today. Intelligent design I'll define in the talk, but evolution itself, people will say Darwinism or evolution. A lot of the quotes that I'll be using are going to be from Philip Johnson, because Philip Johnson is one of the leaders in the intelligent design movement. He uses the word Darwinism.
I always like to try to end our tours at home in Texas, because it's just something about, it really gives you something to look forward to, getting to come home. People mean well, you know, but people in other parts of the country, they think they know what it's like down here. And some of them do, you can tell by the way sometimes when people from other places, when they come down to visit, by the way they dress, they buy all the right clothes, but there's just something about them.
Uh. Texas. Man, as if I couldn't tell. Well, you think you pull your boots on right and wear your hat so well. So pardon me, my laughter, as I sure do understand. Even Moses got excited when he saw the promised land. That's right, you're not Texas. That's right, you're not Texas. That's right, you're not Texas. Texas, anyway, that's right, you're not Texas. That's right, you're not Texas. That's right, you're not Texas. Texas, you anyway. I was born and raised in Texas.
There's more offices to vote for than just keeping some dumb helicopter huntress out of the presidency. There's also the members of the school board, a bunch of unpaid amateurs, often with surprisingly little sense or education, but with more power than most of us are aware. Because they get to decide how your children's understanding will be undermined. Abstinence-only sex education. They want to eliminate elements of history that might be embarrassing to Protestant Christianity, and they want to minimize language and social studies in order to keep our children ignorant and insular. Committed to voting against science. Here we have a couple of college dropouts who never graduated, so of course they pass on their ignorance by homeschooling their children. Why the hell are they on the Board of Education? This guy is the vice chairman. You think he'd let his kids jump to the conclusion that evolution really happens, just like all the scientists in Texas say it does? Promote or permit your children to achieve a level of education he himself could not? Remember, these people aren't just misleading their own kids. They're in charge of misleading our kids. How did we get such a sorry-ass majority voting bloc in this state?
The stupid! It burns!
Mostly due to this man.
James Leininger. L-E-I-N-I-N-G-E-R, Texas mega millionaire, paymaster of the Republican religious right, also known as God's sugar daddy.
He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars and is known as the Daddy Warbucks of the Republican religious right in Texas. He donated a couple $100,000 just to seat right-wing conservatives on the BOE, including a $20,000 donation to fund McLeroy's campaign. And now that he's the chair, McLeroy has already begun loopholing religion into the public schools in ways no one else has done before. But it's even worse than that. What happened in Kansas and in Dover, Pennsylvania is about to happen here in Texas, too. Ralph Silke is a professional creationist from Minnesota who apparently tours the country reciting his testimony of incredulity, hoping to sell his snake oil to would-be educators of whatever state will buy.
That's right. That's right, you're not Texas. That's right, you're not Texas. Texas, that's right, you're not Texas. That's right, you're not Texas. That's right, you're not Texas. Texas.
He and co-conspirator Stephen Meyer have co-written a creationist textbook on evolution in which there are four falsehoods already repeated just in the introduction. Neither of these men are Texans.
Carpetbagger!
And it's a conflict of interest that they should choose our textbooks when they wrote one to suit their agenda, and they're the worst possible example of personal bias in this matter.
Stupid!
How biased are they?
Burn!
Stephen Meyer is the vice president of the Discovery Institute, the intelligent design headquarters in Seattle. He has no business choosing the science standards of this or any other state.
Carpetbagger!
Yet, he and other creationists were selected by our mostly YECBOE for that very purpose. Worse still, Don McLeroy became the chairman of the board and still doesn't know dick about jack about anything about science, and has in fact only become a more outspoken enemy against
witless window-licking clown cars.
When I saw that he had made a public statement to the effect that magic should be treated as part of science, I sent an email to every member of the BOE and received only one response. It lamented the fact that the Board of Education is controlled by the religious right and that they've made their agenda clear that they will vote against the body of research that supports the teaching of evolution in our science.
A little longer, and next time somebody laughs at you, you just tell them you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas, that's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas, that's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas.
DK Chesterton, 100 years ago, 1908, basically made an interesting observation that Christians are quite free to believe that there's a considerable amount of settled, but the materialist is not allowed to admit into a spotless machine the slightest speck of spiritualism or miracle. And I think that really describes it exactly when you want to see these people can't stand anything getting into their spotless machines. Certainly, origin of life that spontaneously rose chemically is not supported by the Bible. It's not supported by the evidence. So maybe that is the target.
Won't you let me help you, mister? Just pull your hat down the way I do and buy your pants just a little longer. Next time somebody laughs at you, you just tell them you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas, don't you get it? That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas, don't you get it? That's right, you're not from Texas.
Hey, Dad, can you buy me a dinosaur just like Jesus used to have? I learned all about it in my biology class. Yiva diva do. Can I get into Stanford? How about Cornell? God bless Texas.
How do we do it? 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 We need your business. We're going out of business.
Our money supply is certainly worried about the inflationary prospects down the road.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
What happened in the Great Depression was, the way I understand it, was that people were using investments as collateral to borrow more money to make more investments.
Mm-hmm.
And it really seems like this is almost exactly the same thing, and this is the margin call. Am I right or in the ballpark? Or?
You're absolutely in the ballpark. You're absolutely right. There was an incredible amount of leveraging in the economy among financial institutions in the past decade or so to incredible heights. This is one of the very strong similarities. I said there were some differences, but there are some similarities between now and the Great Depression, and I'd say that's really near the top of the list. Our financial institutions became highly leveraged. And now, with this collapse in consumer confidence and retail sales and the prospect of a recession, and we see a similar deleveraging now beginning among financial institutions that you saw during the deflationary period of the Great Depression.
Jeez.
It goes beyond the subprime crunch, but the whole heart of this whole thing is a crime against poor people who basically were talked into taking mortgages that they couldn't afford by slick mortgage brokers and the like, moved into these homes at a low teaser rate, and then found them unaffordable, and then now moving out. 3.5 million families facing foreclosure. Houston knows about Katrina because so many of the people from New Orleans came to Houston. But we're talking now about a 50-state Katrina. We're talking about 3.5 million families, 21 million homes underwater, that is to say, worth less than people are paying on them. Okay, we're talking about mounting inflation. We're talking about joblessness, 750,000 jobs so far that they officially acknowledge. I'm sure it's a lot more than that. So as we rocket and careen, not simply into a recession, but potentially into something much worse. Don't you think the government wanted to solve this problem? When the markets melted down in August 2007 over the subprime lending, you know, they discovered that these asset-based secured-backed securities had no assets backing them, that it was all a fraud, and banks started writing down billions of dollars. The Federal Reserve Bank immediately swung into action and began cutting interest rates, and now they've done it 8 times. And the net effect of it has been to increase inflation. It has not actually stabilized the situation. They've injected hundreds of billions of dollars into banks, into financial institutions, into money market funds, et cetera, et cetera. And the markets are still going down. So what they're doing is not working. The bailout started out. It was going to be a bailout, you know, three-page document, a bailout, basically buy up the toxic waste mortgages on the balance sheets of these banks. Then they decided not to do that. Instead, they were going to pump money into the banks. This wasn't even approved by Congress, okay? Henry Paulson just took control here and began to pump money into banks, but with no public control. In other words, they weren't saying, here's $100 billion, but to get this, you have to you know, cut back your executive compensation. You have to do X, Y, and Z. They don't have to do anything. They just get the money because there's a desperate panic here to try to keep the juice up the economy and get more liquidity into the system. So any kind of public accountability, any kind of transparency seems to be out the window. I mean, there are no public interest people or labor people sitting on the boards making these decisions. Today, Henry Paulson was interviewed in the New York Times, and he says, you know, maybe, he says, I should have, paid more attention to the subprime crisis sooner, he admits. Then he goes on to say, well, if I did, I'm not sure I would have done anything differently. This is the Treasury Secretary. Unbelievable, okay? Alan Greenspan today said, you know, gee, I'm really shocked that this has happened. This is shocking. And you know, clearly, we lack regulation. You know, of course, Alan Greenspan was lobbying for a lack of regulation. So suddenly, these people are making sort of grudging admissions with no real apologies. They're not really being held accountable. And you know, the FBI basically indicted 400 people in the mortgage scams. They've announced a criminal investigation of 26 companies. They've opened 1,400 cases. They've created 40 task forces. And then last week, the New York Times reports the FBI doesn't have the staff to actually pursue these investigations. Why? Because they're, you know, because of 9/11, because they're chasing terrorists around, okay? Or so they claim, okay? So here we have a situation where, you know, our money, our finances are not being protected. I'm not just talking about them. I'm talking about our 401ks. I'm talking about our retirement funds. I'm talking about, you know, very direct things that affect every single person in this country. And it seems as if nobody wants to pay attention to this. It's like, oh, did you hear what Sarah Palin, said about so-and-so and such-and-such and that she had a $150,000 clothing allowance from the Republican Party? Isn't that horrible? You know, I mean, in other words, people want to talk about issues that will distract us, but not issues that really take us closer to real power in America. And I think this is unfortunately true of progressives as well. I don't know if you agree with, but the, you know, you speak to people and they say, well, you know, I really don't understand this. And what about, we have to fight to end the war. And, you know, it's just we go back to the safe ground, not paying attention to the fact that we are, you know, on the edge of a possible depression. You know, which is a kind of a game changer, a life changer for everybody in this country. And there's no economic justice movement. Maybe there will be after the election, but there's nobody really standing up about this. There is going to be a protest on Wall Street tomorrow. There have been a bunch of them there. But this is not an issue that has really caught fire with progressives. They would much rather, you know, talk about why McCain and why Bill O'Reilly is bad, bad, bad. In my opinion, that's a cop-out.
I made it run. I made it run against time. Once I built a railroad, and now it's done. But against paradigm, once I built a tower. Way up to the sun, with bricks and mortar and lime. Once I built a railroad, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Well, you know, I wrote this book. Here's what happened. I did the film In Debt We Trust. The film came out. I did screenings. A lot of people who came to see it liked it. But, you know, the reviews were tepid. You know, they were basically saying, hey, you're exaggerating here. This is, you're an alarmist. You're a doom and gloomer. Everything is going well. How can you project a crisis when everything seems to be doing great? Okay? That was my frustration. So I began to, like, just track what was happening. And that evolved into this book, Plunder, which came out a week before Lehman Brothers went down. So maybe I should claim credit for it. But nevertheless, I mean, I've been trying to explain this to people, and I've found a kind of a wall of denial. It's because we don't want to talk about money, most of us. We made mistakes. We haven't handled our money right. We're behind on our credit cards. A lot of different reasons, okay? But basically, there's been this transfer of hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth from the poorest people in America to the richest, and nobody's talking about it. I mean, I met with Sheila Jackson Lee. She's in my film, In Debt We Trust, the congresswoman from Houston, okay? And she was almost in shock about this. She was saying that people are not paying attention to what's going on here, that this is a basically the biggest ripoff in American history. This isn't, you know, I grew up at a time when there were movies, Bonnie and Clyde, you know, movies about people robbing banks. Now the banks are robbing us. And nobody's paying attention to it. You know, every time you get a late fee or a finance charge tacked on to your credit card bills, and all of a sudden, you know, everything is costing you incredibly more money, and they make the rules themselves. There's no regulation. There's no accountability. So this is something that is a direct threat to our economic survival on one hand. On the other hand, it's a classic example of a lack of democracy and accountability. Essentially, you know, power has been transferred from the public to the private. You know, people here are like, wow, can we win the president? You know, whoever wins the presidency, you think they're going to have any money to do anything? You think they're going to have much range? Both parties have taken large chunks of money from the very companies that are at the core of this crisis.
Greg Palast.
Hey, Greg. So good to hear your voice. How you doing?
Okay. Getting through this veil of tears called election season.
Yeah. You know, we were just talking about the direction that the country's going right now. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean,
no.
What the hell's going on? You know, I mean, what's going on? The economy's falling, and at the same time, our rights are being eroded. What the hell?
Well, but people are reacting. I mean, I think it's actually heady times. Whether you think Obama is, you know, the one, I don't know. Whether he will affect change, I don't know. What's much more important than any of that, than a candidate, is that, you know, polls are really showing that people have had it up to here with losing civil rights, losing jobs, losing homes, losing lives in Iraq. People have just had it up to here. And I mean, basically, suddenly KPFT is kind of the mainstream.
Exactly.
It's Fox News, which is the fringe.
Yeah.
You know, that they should be doing fun drives. Why? We're the center now, baby.
Yeah.
So you guys should be happy.
Yeah, well, no? Fox News is in third place, I believe, right now in the ratings.
And we're first in soul power. Now listen. However, here's the dark cloud on the horizon. I've been investigating with Bobby Kennedy. I investigated the theft of 2000 and 2004. Kennedy wrote a Rolling Stone article on the theft of 2004. This week, Kennedy and I have an article in Rolling Stone called Block the Vote, which basically says that the election won't be stolen, but it already has been stolen. And what we mean by that is that 2.7 million voters have been purged from the voter rolls. That's ugly business. One in five voters have had their names removed from the voter rolls of Colorado, the swing state. That's the Florida, Ohio of 2008. One in nine in New Mexico. It is ugly, ugly business out there, and they are blocking voters from voting. They're purging. They're stopping people from getting their names on the voter registries, all due to a new law, the Help America Vote Act. George Bush is not helping us vote, so look out.
Great.
And, yeah, so, but there's something you can do about it. And before, that's where I got to emphasize this. You can steal it back. So Kennedy and I'm Greg Palast, in case you just tuned in. Kennedy and I have come up with, facing this emergency, have done what we think is the most important thing we can do, which is to write a comic book. So we got a comic book.
Here you go.
Steal back your vote. Steal back your vote.
What a great idea. I mean, it just seems just in line with what you do.
Yeah, and it's 24 full-color pages penned by great tunist Ted Rall, Lucas Kettner, Lloyd Dangle, Troubletown. It's really true investigative reporting. This is not a kiddie comic. This is like in-your-face, hard-edged investigative reporting. This is the real Transmetropolitan, if you've seen the cartoons based on Hunter Thompson. This is the real thing. This is real investigative reporting illustrated, just like the Rolling Stone article, just it has some color in it. And it also has, in the 24 pages, the last couple pages, are seven ways to steal back your vote. So in other words, it's not hopeless.
Yeah.
It's been stolen, but you can steal it back. And the other thing you can do is, you want to take a look at the comic book online, you can do that at stealbackyourvote.org. stealbackyourvote.org. And there, by the way, you can download for nothing the film stealbackyourvote, which is what I did for BBC Television, which shows you how they're doing it. The missing voters of New Mexico, the missing voters of Colorado, the foreclosed voters of Michigan. This is how they're stealing this election again. But again, you can steal it back, stealbackyourvote.org for that stuff, and you'll get a copy of the comic book. You get a couple copies. We'll make sure everyone who donates gets a couple copies.
Yeah.
One for yourself and one for your foolish cousin who is about to mail in their ballot. Please don't mail in your ballot. Don't go postal, because one of the things that we found out is that about 1 in 10 mail-in ballots get junked. They know who you are. They know who you voted for. They didn't even have to open the ballot. They know your zip code. They know who you are. So,
yeah. Don't
mail it in. You want to walk it in person. Early voting, please. You want to start voting. Now, that's some of the advice you get. Cheap advice. You also have 800 protection numbers. And I want to tell you a big up to Congresswoman Sissy Fahrenholz, who's been helping us get this out. And Voto Latino, we do have Spanish language translations of it. If you go to stealbackyourvote.org, you can see tonight a piece of it called Nuns on the Run. One of the ways that they're stealing this election is that they are demanding, in many states like Indiana, demanding government photo ID. And you say, well, what's so wrong with that? Well, the answer, what's wrong with that, man, is that not everyone has those things. And in fact, 10 nuns in Indiana were denied the right to vote because they did have driver's licenses, but since they're all in their 80s and 90s, their licenses had expired. They had, so they weren't allowed to vote, even though they voted in one place for like 40 years. They were denied the right to vote.
You got it, buddy. The largest print giver and the small print taketh away. Step right up. You can step right up. You can step right up. Come on, step right up. Get away from me, can't you work? Step right up.
We heard from Aaron Ra via YouTube from Dallas on the Texas School Board, Danny Schechter, Greg Palast, Tim Canova, Thursday Night Radio at good old-fashioned KPFT Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Stacy Davis, Rick, and Wally James. My name's Scooter. You've been listening to the Innerside Radio Program, and I'll see you all next week.
That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anywhere. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anywhere. That's right.
Okay, running out of time. That's it for this week. This has been Glee Glee Productions, and this radio show is produced for not-for-profit community and micropower radio use worldwide. Executive producer is David Preckel. Thank you very much, man, for all your help. Got to run. Here's some change you can count on. And until next week, as always, and forever, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Let's go home. Good idea.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. The journey is over.